From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those of us who work in public radio, a fun drive is kind of like being a parent and having to speak at your kid's class for career day. Today in the program, we're talking a little bit about how radio works, or public radio anyway. It's actually an important part of what we do on this program, explain how something works. So we're going to hear stories today about doing radio from some of the people who have figured this all out. Ira Glass will talk about how stories work and why sound, natural sound, doesn't really matter. Terry Gross talks about the basics of doing an interview, and she tells the story of one interview that goes terribly wrong. We'll also hear from Robert Krulwich and from Jad Abumrad of Radiolab on the importance of failure and how you stay relevant in a form that's been around for a very long time. Radio today, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we thought we were going to bring you a conversation with the New York Times food writer Mark Bittman. We're not. This kind of thing actually doesn't really happen to us all that often, but in the last week or so, it's happened twice. Day of the interview, a publicist gets a few details wrong, and you're left without a show. We are going to get Mark Bittman on this program. As you may know, he's written a book that's getting a lot of attention about the strategy he's developed to lose some weight and eat in a more sustainable way. It's called Eat Vegan Before Six. So stay tuned for that sometime early next month. But in the meantime, since it's a fun drive, we're going to talk about radio. And really, no one understands radio better than Ira Glass. For many years now, Ira's been producing the popular radio program, This American Life. But even before that, when he was covering stories for NPR, Ira came at stories in the same kind of way, with a sort of philosophy about why this piece of tape works and why we're so drawn in. Now, it can seem a little abstruse, but when you listen to the program, the mechanics themselves are kind of invisible. Years ago, this was 2000, I talked to Ira about the characteristics of good radio, and he said something surprising. He said, sound, you know, natural sound, ambient sound, it doesn't always work.
I've come to conclude that what's compelling in stories is not sound. Hmm. Sound is useful to pace something, to give it a different texture. But actually what makes a story great is narrative, is that it's a story, is that the motion of a story. And that a lot of the most compelling radio really is just somebody talking about something which happened to them in a way that means something to them. And in fact, almost all great radio is that. I mean, it's rare for great radio to actually involve the sound of something, you know, and that being the moving part. It's one of these odd things where I feel like we as like people who put together shows started telling ourselves something about ourselves. Which isn't true. Right. And then we came to believe it. I mean, I say this more as a public radio listener than as a producer. Like the moments that I remember, none of them have to do with like the raw quality of the sound. They all have to do with like somebody said something really interesting. And like as soon as you sort of say that out loud, then you're like, oh, wait, that's right. It isn't the sound at all.
Right. I wonder, is this the kind of radio that you always thought about doing, or in some ways had you settled on being kind of a mainstream radio journalist?
I mean, I feel like I am a mainstream radio journalist to start. I feel like, you know, the program that we do is journalism. Yeah. It's just journalism applied to everyday life. It's journalism not applied to public figures usually, though sometimes, and public issues, though sometimes. But I don't know. To answer your question, I always was attracted to the kinds of stories we do on This American Life. Even when I was just a tape cutter, at all things considered, you know, when I was 19 and 20 years old, these are the sort of stories that I tended to work on and sought out just because they just got to me. You know, they just got to me at some level.
I want to ask you about that because I remember when you were working on Weekend, All Things Considered. I think the first piece that I remember of yours from that program was the Dead Animal Man piece. Do you remember it?
Wow. Of course. It's one of – I have to say, like, that piece marked a kind of turning point for me in figuring out how to produce something on the radio.
Maybe you could talk about the way that story helped you evolve or the way your work kind of evolved.
At that point, I had been thinking a lot about why are certain stories getting to me more than others. You know, just thinking about the things that I was putting together and listening to stories that other people had put together. And I had come to a kind of a little sort of theory about how to do a story that I thought would be the most effective form. And that theory went like this. If you think about how to even explain this quickly, I came to feel that the most gripping structure for a radio story would be if there was a sequence of events, and then periodically you'd step out of the sequence of events to reflect on like what that little sequence might mean, like just some bigger something that you learn from that sequence of events, and then dive back into the sequence of events. And in the Dead Animal piece, I simply try to enforce that consciously. What happens, in a way, it's a lot like a lot of This American Life pieces. There's a lot of action at the beginning. You go here and there and here and there, and little things happen. And periodically in the action, it broadens out to make bigger points. For example, what sort of man would pick up dead animals for a living? Society has a deal with people in certain unpleasant jobs. It pays them money, and they handle disgusting-smelling stuff so nobody else has to. Well, meet Clarence Hicks.
I pick up dead animals, huh?
Okay, yeah. As you can see, like part of it is it's an experiment in pacing. That there's this thing, and if you're a radio reporter, that there's a lot of, you know, you have two or three sentences of script, then there's two or three sentences and somebody's quote, you know, quote which lasts two or three sentences, and you come back and another two or three sentences of script, and then the quote is another two or three sentences, like a very steady sort of rhythm. So this, it's always going instead of script, quote, script, quote, which is kind of a traditional way of doing a story. Right. There's a lot of like script, quote, sound, quote, script. Like it's constantly like messing with the rhythm.
Just the idea of introducing the notion of this abstract sense of society having this place for people who do this dirty work, I thought was intriguing. And I remember not stealing the exact terms, but in a story later, I remember sort of stealing the notion of, you know, referring to society in these straight ahead radio pieces, which is why I think it was really amazing work.
Well, in fact, this is the exact thing that I stole. This is the idea that I stole from Alex Chadwick that I had never heard anybody do in the radio, which is that he would be in the middle of some story and then he'd, in like a sentence or two, just for a sentence or two, he would jump out of the story he was in to say, you know, given the way things usually run, you know, you wouldn't think that it would happen this way. Or he would just sort of jump out of it.
Yeah.
And I had never heard anybody do that and just totally lifted that from him and used it in stories like – this is one of the first stories I used that in.
Society has a deal with people in certain unpleasant jobs. It pays them money and they handle disgusting-smelling stuff so nobody else has to. Well, meet Clarence Hicks.
I pick up dead animals. I'm a dead animal man. I pick up dead animals, dead dogs, dead cats or whatever. That's my job.
Washington, D.C. has three dead animal catchers in the Department of Sanitation. This week, I went out with Clarence Hicks.
What highway are we on here?
295, southbound.
You move through space and time very quickly from place to place to place. And sometimes the scenes are as long as, you know, we stopped by here, and then there's a quote which is just 5 or 6 seconds long of he and I like seeing a squirrel on the street that we're going to pick up, and then on to the next thing. It's like super fast.
It's a cat. What is it? It's a cat. This is a cat. It been there for a little while. You know, dried up, see?
It's all flat on one side.
Yep.
The cat's head was still normal, but the body was blackened and dissolving.
So there's a lot of action at the beginning, and then at the end of the piece, there's a long reflective section of probably 2 minutes out of a 7-minute piece or 6-minute piece where he and I just talk about his job. And he and I start talking about the Grim Reaper. It's funny because the content of that part of the interview is fine, but really what mainly gets communicated is the sound of two people talking together nicely. That is, there's a power to simply hearing two people get along.
Do you ever see those pictures of, I guess it's the angel of death, you know, big black hood and kind of a sickle guy, you know, holding a sickle,
yeah.
The Grim Reaper.
I've seen a picture like that. Yeah, back and say, yeah. Why should I let that bother me?
Well, it shouldn't bother you because that's who you are for these dogs.
That's right.
That's you.
Well, I'm the angel. See, when they die, I'm going to take them to heaven.
And I don't know how I got to this point in radio without understanding this, but if you simply have two people talking on the radio in a way that feels real and intimate, as a listener, you get the same feeling as if you had been part of a conversation like that. And so that became a thing that became part of the structure that I wanted to look for in the stories that I was putting together.
Ira, you have said that there has to be something at stake. Tell me what you mean by that.
If you're in production on a radio show, or if you're making anything really, you have to have a way to decide, okay, we're going to do this story rather than that one. In fact, almost everything you're doing is a variation on that decision. Are we going to do this thing or that thing? If we do this thing, is it going to be this way or that way? And people often pitch us stories which are sort of musings, radio essays, musings on this thing that happened to them when they were a kid. You know, for us, we're looking for stories that are real stories where, like, there are characters in a situation and something is at stake and something happens and someone changes or learns something because of it. These are not stories like All Things Considered commentaries. These are not stories like radio essays. These are stories like a movie is a story, like a novel is a story. That is, there's characters, there's a situation, there's something at stake, something happens, someone gets changed. Or if they don't get changed, they get crushed. Okay? And that's one of the ways in which what we're doing is different. That's part of what makes the show different. And the reason why we choose those kinds of stories is just because they're the most powerful. I think that is the storytelling structure that we as a species tend toward in all media. And there's a reason for it. We're hardwired for it. We don't have a choice about that.
It's Ira Glass. He's the host of the program This American Life, which you can hear on KUER Saturdays at 3, Sundays at 6. A few years ago, we spoke with Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air, about interviewing. Now, Terry's been doing interviews for nearly 40 years now. And so we asked her about style and technique, the usual things. When you do this many interviews, you have lots of stories about the good ones, but the best stories are often the bad ones. And there's one really great story about one really bad interview in our conversation, which we'll get to. But here's part of our conversation with Terry Gross from a few years ago.
There are real limitations to the interview as a form. I mean, I've been doing it my whole adult life, and I really love interviews. At the same time, like when you're interviewing somebody about their life, you have to accept that what you're getting is a combination of the truth, self-deception, hyperbole, a few out-and-out lies, faulty memory, and we're all that way. I mean, that's the way we are. I know I'm not going to get, like, that revelation.
Yeah,
you know, like, there's a lot of early movies where finally, like, there's this one psychological revelation and the whole movie is explained. Like, everything is explained. I don't think people are really like that. And I don't think anybody's life really turns on that one revelation. And I don't think interviews kind of bring out that one revelation. What I hope to get is a kind of small snapshot of what the person's like. And to have the pleasure of spending some time with them. And by me, I mean all of us, that we all get that pleasure of hearing them talk.
Right. Are you trying to establish a kind of trust so they can get a sense that you are, in fact, interested in the real part of their lives?
Yeah. And, you know, like some people who come on the show, they know the show. And so they're already there. They have a degree of trust, assuming they like the show, assuming they've heard it and they actually like what they've heard.
Right, right.
Which isn't necessarily true. But then other people come in and they don't really know NPR very well. They don't know the show very well. And they don't know where I'm headed.
Yeah.
And this often happens with some actors. Like a lot of actors know the show, but a lot don't. And I think a lot of people in the performing arts are used to a certain type of the personality press that equates making news with revealing something embarrassing about that person's life, you know, about the celebrity's life.
Yeah.
So where they're heading might be a secret romance, a secret drug habit. And that's not where I'm heading.
Yeah.
But when I ask a biographical question, the guest might kind of freeze as if they fear that where I'm heading is some kind of secret private part of their life. And I try to build up some trust by asking questions that I will hope sound like not show-off questions, but informed questions, questions that will, you know, will show that I know and care about their work.
Have you found that you can get, at times, you can get more out of the simpler questions than the bigger ones, the deeper ones?
Well, some of the deeper ones, sound so highfalutin if you ask them.
Yeah.
You can't ask somebody like, so what is the meaning of life?
Right.
Or like, what's the most important thing that ever happened to you that transformed your life forever?
Right.
Once people start to talk that way, you know that they've worked on it. You know, too many years of therapy or working too hard to boil down your narrative to like a dramatic structure. But I always think like what the interview should leave you with is some kind of sum total of everything that was asked and answered.
Hmm. Well, there are a lot of questions about Gene Simmons, the Kiss mm-hmm. bassist, of mm-hmm. course. And I want to play a clip from it because I noticed a couple of things in it. I mean, beyond the obvious. I mean, it was good. It was good. Theater in some ways, right? It was good drama.
Absolutely.
Certainly made for great radio. But it also revealed, some techniques here. And I wanted to play a clip and ask you about one in particular, a couple actually. This is Terry talking with Gene Simmons, the bassist, of course, from Kiss.
You're very defensive on money, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I'm actually just trying to show you that there's a big world out there. And reading books is wonderful. I've certainly read, well, perhaps as many as you have, but there's a delusional kind of notion that runs rampant in...
Wait, could we just get something straight?
Of course.
I'm not here to prove that I'm smart.
Not
I'm not
you.
Here to prove that you're not smart or that you don't read books
not,
or can't make a lot of money.
This is not about you. You're being very defensive. Why are you doing that?
It's contagious.
Yeah.
Can we get back to your makeup? What do you use to paint your face, and do you ever break out from it?
No, it's actually oil-based. It's Stein's makeup is one of the brand names, but you can use lots of things. I don't think I've ever been asked that question, but no, my skin is more beautiful than yours. I would be quite more popular in jail if I so chose.
What do you do to take the makeup off? What do you use?
You use Pons, you know, the same stuff women do, or you can use a Stein's concoction, which is, you know, sort of similar but more industrious. Industrial. Industrious means sort of ambitious. Industrial in strength.
Okay, Terry, what are you doing there? Because, I mean, it's starting to fall apart, and then you go back to something so particular as his makeup.
Right.
What were you doing?
Okay, what I was doing was this. Gene Simmons is baiting me every step of the way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And insulting me and kind of playing with me. And before I kind of totally give up and just start insulting him back, I'm going to try to get this back to a conventional interview. Before I kind of give in, I want to know I've tried everything to make this interview work as a conventional interview. I'm going to go back to his music. I'm going to go back to his makeup, which he's famous for. Even the title of his book is Kiss and Makeup. He knows he's famous for makeup.
Sure.
And I figure this is interesting. I mean, you know, when men wear makeup like that, what do they do to take it off? And does he break out? Because that is a problem with makeup. I mean, I can't wear makeup. My skin is much too sensitive. So, I can't wear like makeup base and all that stuff. So, you know, and then when he keeps fighting me on all of that eventually, then I figure, okay, I give up. Let's just have it out. You write in your book you've had 4,600 sexual liaisons over the years.
You're supposed to say so far.
So far.
Right.
To you, this will be asking the obvious, but why have you wanted so many encounters?
I can only spell it in three letters, M-A-N. When a woman, and look, I'm not here to say that I'm a scientist or pretend or portend to be anything else. Those are semantics, of course, but then neither you nor I are anti-semantic. The notion is plain, and I read a book called Myth of Monogamy, which actually sort of bring you down than if I was a dentist. I didn't make those rules. I come from Israel. I'm simply a student at your feet. This is what I've noticed.
Are you interested in music
at all?
Don't
you love this interview? Tell me the truth.
Well, I think it's kind of a drag because you're making speeches and you're being intentionally obnoxious.
No, I'm not. I'm being a man.
So, Terry, what did you hate most about that interview? I mean, because you said here, you know, he's making speeches and he's performing. And you didn't want the performing Gene Simmons. You wanted the real guy, right?
That's always the goal, to get the real guy. But in some ways, I think I got the real guy.
Yeah, you did.
I got so many letters after the interview from people who actually know him or have had encounters with him in one way or another, saying, like, that's how he is. He's really obnoxious.
Really?
So this might be the real guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, when he was baiting me there and saying, like, it's because I'm a man,
yeah,
you know, and this is what women want. Then I had to think, like, okay, what do I do? Do I give him, like, feminist lecture 101?
Right,
Mr. Simmons, women aren't made to be walked on like this. Women aren't sex toys, Mr. Simmons. Do I do that? Or do I just – so what I said to him was, I said, boy, is this the only way you can talk to a woman, is to do this shtick?
Yeah.
Because I wanted my question to imply, like, man, this is so tiresome. You know what I mean? I didn't want him to think, like, that he was getting to me and
yeah,
that
yeah. –
But rather, like, man, this is so tiresome. Like, why do this shtick? Like, just you know, give it up. Grow up.
Well, I wonder, what were the conversations like after you'd, you know, done the thing and you were figuring – was there a question whether you'd put that on the air?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because this was not the interview we were expecting.
Right.
And then the question was, is this a good – an interesting disaster or merely a disaster?
Yeah.
We really couldn't tell. So we figured, let's put it on the shelf for a while and then listen back to it in a couple of weeks and decide.
Uh-huh.
So Amy, the producer who booked Gene Simmons and was producing the interview, listened to it. I listened to it. And Danny Miller, our executive producer, listened to it. And we all agreed, it's an interesting disaster.
Right.
this interview isn't going to win any Peabody Awards. But on the other hand, it's going to make for interesting radio. And boy, I really have no regrets about that. I mean, I'm sure Gene Simmons felt that he really put me in my place, but I feel like I owe him one because the interview got so much attention.
It's Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air, which, of course, you can hear on here on KUER at 1 o'clock. So today in the program, we're talking about radio and how it works, and we'll take a break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're getting a little meta on you. We're talking about how radio works, at least for those who do it well. It's the best thing on radio. You hear it all the time as a shorthand for the program Radiolab. Since it's not easy to explain just what it is, most people just describe how good it is. But basically, Radiolab is a documentary radio show that's about science. It's this presentation of an idea that's layered and embroidered with sound and voices. And over the years, we've spoken with both of the hosts of Radiolab, Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich. For more than 30 years now, Robert Krulwich has held his ground as the most inventive, original, curious storyteller on radio, or on television, really, for that matter. Robert has actually written and had performed an opera to explain interest rates. He explained economic or scientific principles. He enlisted his co-workers to perform country music and act like mice. Back in 2011, we talked with Robert about life in radio, and he told us that it all began with his mother.
My mom was a great storyteller and also a great gatherer. She was the kind of person where you'd go to Bloomingdale's and you'd get on the bottom of the escalator with your mom and, you know, with bags and everything. And then some random lady would sew up next to my mother. And there would be like 35 seconds till you got to the next floor and had to make the turn. And by the top of the elevator, the lady next to my mother would be saying, you know, incredibly private things. So I said to him, if he feels that way, then we can get a divorce immediately and that kind of thing. And so I saw my mom doing that. And I guess that kind of bled into my being, because my sister is very similar. She knows how to she's a photographer at The New York Times. And she can't really walk up the street without noticing all kinds of things that everybody else would miss. So, and she knows how to frame them and turn them into picture stories. So I think that somehow, although there was no journalism tradition in our house, there was a very rich vein of theatricalized storytelling, for sure.
You know, you said that having all of these years of experience really only gives you so much help for a piece, because you said each story has its own, and this is how you put it, internal music.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, if something happens before you that's sad or that's mysterious or something else happens before you that's violent and clear or appears to be, then the way you address it is going to be different. And in some places, in one case, you have to search maybe for the meaning of the situation, and you have to choose soft and careful cadences, and you are striking a mood. Each story has a mood, and each mood then invites a certain kind of way of speaking. So if somebody just leapt out and grabbed you by the throat and then clunked you over the head with a hammer, and I was just trying to say, you wouldn't believe what happened. All of a sudden, in he comes, boom, with a hammer, no less, ow, and, you know, so that's that. But if you started to cry because you read something about your kid's report card, and say, well, he was holding the card in his hand, and he leaned over, and he turned away from me, and there was a kind of quiet. So you see that, in the first case, there's lots of noise and a sort of a pizzicato sort of feeling and lots and lots of sharps. And another one, the silences are important and the thing is just down in the mouth and lower in the voice. And so that's what I mean. Every story is a little bit of a universe. And if you've done 55 stories and this is your 56th, the 56th can't be like the previous 55. It is its own world. And you have to make very specific choices. And the fact that you have a track record gives you, well, what I say to Jed sometimes is, because he has the same situation, I say, look, you'll get out of this forest because you've done it before. But the fact that you are panicking and feeling that you're lost and whatever, that's good. That means you've never been here before, because this is the first time you've told this story. So you haven't ever been here before. So that's true. And then this horrible, horrible feeling you're feeling right now is just. And you will be handsomely rewarded if you figure it out.
I want to play a piece of tape. This is from for a couple of reasons. One, it's interesting to hear Robert Crowell with your voice when you were a little younger. Mm-hmm. I have to say, though, it's really interesting when you hear, and I've heard pieces from other reporters, myself among them, and you know. Styles change, and clearly your style has changed. I'm not suggesting that, but it's interesting the cadences are there, even from this piece. This is called Ancient Rites. It was a piece in 1983.
I don't even remember that one.
This was a piece where you were talking about the rent in Babylon.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And you were comparing.
I should warn you, though, that I would go through phases where, like, I was going to be Ira Flatow all week, or I'd become Neil Conan. They have a thing like the women in NPR also would like all be Linda Wertheimer for a few months, and then everyone would switch and become Susan Stamberg. There's a strange, it's like menstrual cycles coming into the same sort of mode. Well, among boys, there's an awful lot of under the table sort of miming and sort of borrowing and stealing that goes on too, and it filters up in pretty much the same way. So I don't know what you're about to play, but if I sound like Neil Conan, that's just because I was having a Neil Conan period.
Well, it sounds like Robert Krulwich to me. Here's a piece from 1983. It's called Ancient Rites.
And you are now going to listen to Ira Splarr. He translates Mesopotamian tablets at the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art. He's reading a tax receipt.
The son of Iti Marduk Balatu was debited against.
He's got hundreds of tax receipts there, and sales orders and labor contracts written on little clay tablets shaped like Wheaties, the breakfast cereal, and preserved on the desert for 5,000 years.
He was in charge of the distribution of sweet beer.
You would be amazed at what you can learn about Mesopotamian business life. For example, in 1982, he turned up a set of rental agreements. These are leases for some houses in downtown Babylon around 500 BC, and they came with very precise descriptions.
Yes, we do have the amount of rooms, how much access there is to the street.
But what did they charge? What was the rent for a nice house in Babylon?
Robert Krulwich, what are you hearing there in that piece?
I remember that because I went to Babylon, Long Island, and found a realtor, and I tried to say, can you beat this offer from 5,000 years ago for a summer rental? And she was like crazy, or was it he? I can't remember. She said, well, we have washers and dryers. Yeah. I haven't thought of that one for a long time.
Well, I think what's interesting about it is the way you write into the dynamic of the writing into the tape. You know, I'm not sure who you were playing that particular
No, that was sort of an invention at the time because no one did that in those days. So I just – and there was a little worry about it at NPR. But I was working for a guy named Jim Russell who went, all right, well, go ahead.
Right.
Yeah, sort of an easy sort of editing style. So
I have to get you to tell this story of – this was in 1977. Well, I think this says a lot about you, about just who you are. You had become this kind of Zelig-like character and it kind of got you in trouble, got you benched, as you put it at NPR, for essentially – I guess what you were doing was kind of taking on the accents of the people you were interviewing, or one particular person anyway.
So I had gotten into a little trouble going to the Texas State Fair because when I went around the Texas State Fair, I inadvertently became Texan. That is, I just began to get a Texas accent as I talked to people. And so people pointed out to me, like, be careful, don't do that. It's embarrassing to you. And people know that you're putting on a phony accent. And I promised not to do it. But the truth is I was unaware that I was doing it. And then one day, Judith Miller, then of the New York Times, but then she was at NPR, she said to me, well, I'm going to interview Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's the president of the United States, who was a new president, Jimmy Carter, and he had just appointed this guy to be his national security advisor, something really important. And I wasn't all that keen on politics. I didn't quite know anything, but she thought, well, just come in here and you can like get him loose and ask him things. I said, okay. So it was Judy and me in the room with Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Zbigniew Brzezinski had a rather thick accent. And so I sit down and I say to him, so what's your name? And he says, I'm Zbigniew Brzezinski. What kind of a name is that? He said, well, it's Polish. I said, where are you from? He says, I'm from Łódź. I said, Wodj. How do you say W-O-D-J? And I don't know, slowly but surely, I'm just talking along. We're having a time. And Judy's looking a little white in the face. And then I notice that through the glass, the room, the control room, is getting very crowded as all the people who are normally wearing ties and who are all communications professors and were in charge of us are piling into the room. Because for NPR to interview a president, I mean, we weren't a big thing in those days. And so when an important person came in, it was serious. And apparently, I had begun to speak increasingly thicker Polish accented English to this man. So I had gone from, so Wodz, what is that? He says, well, it's a place in Poland. I said, in Poland. We're in Poland. And as it went on, I was leaning over and going, so you have all of these people who are trying to do the right thing. What would you do, Zbigniew Brzezinski, when you, and I'm really honestly unaware. Meanwhile, Judy has written with lipstick, stop it. It wasn't a towel, it was actually a napkin of some kind. And she slides it across the thing. And so I'm going, so hold on a second. Oh, I see we're out of time. Because I didn't know. And, you know, I had no, so I was, that was all hell to pay for that. Because then I was told I couldn't go on the air. I was obviously at a mental case of some sort. And I was on probation so I became an editor for a few months because I was untrustworthy.
It's Robert Krulwich, science correspondent for NPR, where he's been a reporter for many years, of course. Also, the co-host of the program Radiolab. Now, the stories on Radiolab are always different, but there is a kind of architecture there. This is how Robert and Jad Abumrad have described it. They say the show is built around two guys who have met, say, for breakfast and are chatting about and this idea, and they're working through it. And that's exactly how Radiolab did get started. In fact, Robert Krulwich and Jad both started meeting at a diner, and then one thing led to another. In the fall of 2010, we had Jad Abumrad on the program. He had just been awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant, so we were talking to him about how that must feel for people to recognize your accomplishments and take it so far as to say, hey, you're a genius. But we also talked a lot about failure and change and how you stay relevant. And we talked about the discomfort that comes with trying to do something new.
You look at in biology, you know, any change of state, you know, these little molecules that are undergoing state changes, they get very agitated. They vibrate. They jostle all around. They're unhappy. Mm. You know, it's not a good thing, but it is what makes life, you know, happen. And so you can see that feeling, that crappy feeling you get when you're in the middle of a life change. You can see that as a bad thing and something that needs to end. Or you can see it as an invitation, you know, like, okay, I feel crappy, therefore I'm doing my job, therefore I'm where I should be. And it's a subtle shift, it's a reframing that can make all the difference in the world. And it has for me because, you know, every story we tell, Doug, you go through a period of despair where you're like, this story sucks. Mm. no one's going to listen to this story. I can't figure out the right structure. I can't figure out what sounds to put in. You know, I can't get the edit to do what it's supposed to do. And you can see that as a terrible thing and beat yourself up. Or you can see that as, oh, this is just part of the process. This is what I have to go through in order to get to the other side.
So you're asking yourself now these questions about, okay, how do we keep it so it, you know, so it keeps working? I mean, how do we make it relevant? And you've talked about this conversation. You had this conversation with a guy named Mark Russell. He's the director of the Public Theater in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
That seemed really important because he talks about how this works in theater, how he thinks about it. And that seems to have given you some insights into all of this.
Yeah, Mark Russell said something to me that really sort of stuck in my head. You know, theater, maybe there's an analogy to draw between radio and theater, because both of them, I think that radio is very vibrant, and I think there are a lot of people who rely on radio every single day. So there's some differences. But in the theater, I think it's a real question. Like, why would anyone go to the theater right now when you have movies, when you have a million things you could watch in a second on your computer? Like, why would you go to the theater? And I think you can ask the same question about radio. Why would anyone listen to the radio when you could watch TV or you could go to the internet? Or now I literally could entertain myself for days just with my iPhone.
Right.
You know, like, it's a real question. And so what he put to me is that when he's choosing new work for the Public Theater, he does it with one question in mind always, which is, why theater now?
Right.
Every single choice he makes is an effort to answer that one simple question. So every curatorial decision is based on, is this show answering that question in some sense, or is it helping me think differently about that question? And I wondered out loud whether we in radio have enough radio that is answering that question. You know, I don't know the answer to that, frankly, Doug. I'm not saying we do or we don't, but I'm wondering if I'm asking the question because I think it's an interesting question to ask as we move forward.
Well, to me, that seems the point is the question. You know what, and it seems like one of those dynamics that seems to come into place in all kinds of successful ventures. You know, great art or great film or great radio. It seems like you're not satisfied with it. You don't feel there's not a complacency that. There's that sense that isn't working, even if you kind of know that it is and you know lots of people are listening, that you don't ever feel completely satisfied with it. And it kind of makes you wonder is that even sustainable as a creative person if you're never completely happy with it? And I'm going to guess that the show, even though you're very proud of it, you probably wince from time to time listening to it, right?
More than from time to time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, every show we make has one or two moments I'm deeply proud of, and it has 20 or 30 moments I go, oh, wow, you know. And I don't know. I mean, it's dispositionally, it's hard for me to sort of say why it works that way for me. I think it's just, you know, I mean, you know, if you're running a sensible operation, you figure out a way to make something where you understand the difference. Emotionally, you understand the difference between the guy that you are on the radio and the guy that you are in person.
Yeah, yeah.
On some level, I could pretend to understand that difference, you know. But really, when it comes down to it, everything is personal to me. You know, every story that we tell, we all pour ourselves into it in a really deep way. Maybe not a healthy way, I don't know. But so, you know, when you hear it back and it doesn't sound like you sound to yourself, or it doesn't feel like you feel to yourself, it does hurt a little tiny bit. At the same time, you understand that, like, those winces they become ordinary because you know, like, oh yeah, this is just what happens when I hear my own voice. And so I sort of laugh at that inside my own psyche at this point. I'm like, ha, ha, you're doing that thing again. But I don't know.
You know, you've talked about when you were producing Radio Lab in the earliest days. and it's kind of in its earliest incarnation, which is not at all what it is now. But in those earliest days, you've talked about how it seemed like it was life or death. You described there was this kind of radical uncertainty that came to you. And I'm wondering if you – I wanted you to kind of talk about that. But also if you – if it worries you that you don't feel that way, or do you feel that way? And do you miss that terror? I think you described it as genuine terror.
I'm starting to worry that I'm sounding way too dysfunctional right now. Yeah, you know, it's at the very, very beginning, I was so brand new. No one was listening, really no one. I think probably like objectively there was zero people listening because it was on the AM on Sunday nights and they had to kill the power to avoid interfering with other stations. So you really couldn't get the signal.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know why it felt like life or death, Doug, but it just did. You know, it felt like my life was on the line. Every show, I had to put out something beautiful that literally my own mother would hear and no one else. But I'm not quite sure why that was. You know, I think it was an uncertainty. It was a sense of like, I just don't know who I am right now. I don't know very basic questions like what do I sound like? You know, like just. I think back to that, and like there was the NPR sound where you talk in a very kind of, you know, stentorian kind of way.
Yeah.
And then there was Ira Glass, who was, you know, smacking his lips a lot and being very personal. And I loved Ira, like deeply loved Ira, but I didn't want to be Ira because that would be like, you know, that would be, you could be dismissed in a second. So I was stranded in this middle ground, like, what do I sound like? How do I speak to people? You know, and then you start to think like, if this were a room, are they on the couch next to me? Or are they across a table? Is it formal? Like, you know, you start to kind of get really sort of wound up in your own, you know, negative fantasies. But I just ran into a fugue state. What was your question?
No. Well, I mean, whether you missed that. I mean,
whether I missed it. Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, the thing to me, it seems that was the thing that eventually made that program work was that fear. I mean, that seems like that part of fear that sense of failure is so essential to the creative process.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I could play you some really like that would bring tears of embarrassment to your eyes. I mean, some of the early stuff. I mean, maybe everybody can do that, but I could play you hours and hours of it. But so whether I miss that now, I mean, you know, I miss the neglect a little bit. Like I miss that, like that sense of like you can just disappear and do something. I hated the neglect at that time, but I miss those moments where you could just try something and it doesn't work. I mean, I'll give you an example. We did a podcast. It was based on the highly important question of where in the world does tic-tac-toe not exist?
Yeah.
Like, might there be a place somewhere in the world where no one's heard of this game?
Right.
So we did a 12-minute thing on this, and it was really fun for us, and it was a complete experiment. We just did it on a lark, and we put it out there, and it was just an out-and-out rebellion. Like, we got hundreds of negative comments and hundreds of negative emails, and people thought, no, this is not what you do. You do not do this. You do science. You do big ideas. And so it was this like it was this real pushback, and I miss the days when we could just do stupid things and then walk away from it and be like, yeah, that was dumb. On to the next thing.
Yeah.
So there is a way in which you kind of have to ignore your failures now, because you have to keep failing and you have to keep experimenting and doing things that are a little bit outside yourself, which means they might be outside of your own skills, and they might be really bad. And so it's a little harder to be bad right now, but we're still dedicated to trying to be bad in ways that might inform us to then later be good.
Is there ever a moment, because you've talked about how sometimes you feel trapped by this thing that you've created. So is there ever a moment when you think, okay, you know, it's like the BBC version of The Office. We do 6 episodes, we do another 6 episodes, and we shut it down.
Yeah.
Is there ever a moment when you think, okay, this is great. I mean, it's terrific. I think we might be done.
I mean, if you catch me at a certain moment in the process,
right.
there are many of those moments where I'm like, forget this. Why would I do this? You know what? It can't be that important that we have to work this hard for it. It feels sometimes unjustifiable. But, you know, those are just little tiny moments in a long stream of moments. And broadly, if you averaged out the stream, I feel so damn lucky to do this. I just feel like, you know, I mean, like, what is our job? Our job is to talk to people and to parachute into their lives and learn these fantastically interesting things about other human beings and to experience with them whatever it is they've gone through in a really intimate way. Because, you know, when you turn on the mic with somebody, it just feels like that's all that exists, you and that person for a few moments. And to get to do that as a job feels extremely lucky. It feels like I'm just a few breaks away from being a well-educated bum. But I somehow lucked into a place where I get to sit in a studio in front of this fuzzy mic and talk to people and have them tell me things that are intimate or inspiring or interesting or unnerving. That just feels like a real gift. So I balance out the moments of despair with just a sort of more existential understanding that not everybody gets to do this, and this is a real, real gift.
Jed Abumrad, co-host of Radio Lab, which, of course, you can hear on KUER Sunday evenings at 5 o'clock. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.